How many fingers am I holding up, Winston?
Four.
And if Big Brother were to say not four, but five, then how many?
Four.
Oh. How many fingers, Winston?
Stop it. Anything in the five. But
no, no, Winston.
The pain.
Winston, that is no use. You are lying. You still think you see four.
How can I help with this? Five.
Two and two do not always make four, Winston. Sometimes they make five. Again, how many fingers am I holding up?
That's a clip from the new documentary, Orwell 2 + 2 = 5. That last part is from a 1953 film adaptation of Orwell's novel, 1984. For more, we are joined by Academy Award-winning director Alex Gibney, producer of Orwell, 2 + 2 = 5, and by the film's director, Raoul Peck, the acclaimed Haitian filmmaker. His past films include Exterminate All the Brutes, I Am Not Your Negro. That's one of my favorite documentaries of all time. The Young Karl Marx, Lumumba, Death of a Prophet, and Haiti, The Silence of the Dogs. Raoul Peck served as Haiti's culture minister in the 1990s. We welcome you both back to Democracy Now! Raoul, we'll talk about the origins of this film, why you decided to make this.
Well, Alex, it's better to answer that first question. You want to tell it?
Well, no, I got a call from a man who had assembled all the rights to Orwell's works and wondered if I wanted to executive produce it. I said yes on one condition, if we can get Raoul Peck to direct it. And so I turned to Raoul, and luckily he answered my call and said yes. So that's how it started. But it also seemed like a film. I mean, it began some years ago. It was like 2 or 3 years ago we started on this project. It was relevant then, and we had no idea how relevant it was to become.
Yeah, and I remember when we started working on it, for me, Kamala Harris was going to be president. So, and despite that, I knew that this country and many other countries around the world needed Orwell to come back, and because he had been one of the incredibly analyzer of how totalitarian regime, but also any type of abuse of power function. You know, he teach us how the signs, how to recognize the signs. And, you know, coming from Haiti as a young man and young boy, I also recognize the signs. You know, the attack on the press, the attack on justice, the attack on academia, the attack on any institution that can be a bulwark against totalitarian. And we are living again and again, not only in the United States, but in many other countries, including in Europe, in Latin America, in Africa, the same playbook playing again and again.
So, Raoul, you've said in another interview, I don't make biographies. I choose a moment in the life of a character that allows me to tell the bigger story. For Orwell, I found that moment quite rapidly. So if you could elaborate on that. So Alex comes to you with the idea of this film. And what do you think of Orwell?
An idea to which I say yes immediately. I don't know why, but that happened. But you're not offered every day to be able to immerse yourself in the whole body of work of an author that you revere and that is important, like James Baldwin was important for me too. But I know that before plunging into it, I had to find the story. I had to find, indeed, I don't do biography. I try to find a story with a character, with emotions, with contradictions, and a story that allows you to see a film multiple times, not just for what is happening now, currently, but also that you can watch in 30 years and you will learn as much. So the story for me was Orwell in the last year of his life, where he's struggling to finish 1984, and he will finally finish it, but will die 4 months later, and he's only 49. So the drama of that, you know, and the struggle to finish that, you know, for an author, I thought would give me the fine line of the story and allow me to revisit all his body of work.
Writing through dealing with tuberculosis before he died. But for especially the younger generation, who he was, why he came to have this view, this warning to the world about totalitarianism, authoritarianism.
Well, because it's, you know, people have thought, including myself, you know, reading Orwell when I was young, always thought of him as a sort of dystopian and science fiction author. But in fact, he was writing about things that he went through in his life, being born in India. And that's why I use that photo of Orwell as a baby in the hand of a black nanny. And then he went to Myanmar today, you know,
Burma
at the time, which was a British colony. Mm-hmm. And he went there as 19-year-old as a soldier there, and he realized the price of colonialism. He was himself the bully. He was on the wrong side. And that experience, I think, shaped his whole thinking, and he wrote about it in a very candid and open way and critical way. And then the Spanish War, again, as a young man, he's in his 30s, to volunteer to fight with the Republic against the Putschists, Franco, etc. So all those moments shape his mind. And, you know, there is a phrase where he said, you know, after the Spanish Civil War, I knew where I stand. And that was the turning point for him, and of, as well for the film to establish who he was actually was, and his whole writing, saying that I want to, you know, to write about politics and art together. It was never a contradiction for him.
And indeed, he said the decision not to make art about politics is itself a political decision. Which
yeah,
you...
and as you say, neutrality cannot be is also a political position. Mm-hmm. You know, you can't be neutral. Neutral of what? Mm-hmm. You know.
But the other, you talked a little bit about his time in. He was born in India, but I think he was just a few months old when his mother brought him back to England. But then he spends, as you said, from 1922 to 27. 5 years working as a policeman in, at the time, British colonized Burma. And as a policeman, he says that he was part of the actual machinery of despotism, and as a result of which, another quote from the film, that he operates, quote, on a simple theory that the oppressed are always right and the oppressors wrong. A mistaken theory, but the direct result of being one of the oppressors yourself. So if you could talk about that, and then also we'll get into, you know, the extent to which, of course, this experience with colonialism, a direct one, as one of the colonizers, but then also the question of class. Throughout the film, he explains his own formation by his position, as he calls it, being lower upper middle class.
Yes. Well, the first part of the question, you know, I had a very good friend, the writer Russell Banks, and we had that discussion many times. He said the real story of racism in America can only be told by somebody who was a member of the Klan. And it's a little bit the same way. If you have been in the belly of the beast, you have learned how the beast think. You have all the instrument. You know how they function, etc. And that's what Orwell was able to do. You know, he was doing things that he would come to regret, but he knew them intimately. And about the second part of your question, I forgot it.
About class.
You know, that's I was thinking recently about how every politician in this country is using permanently the middle class, as if it's like something. You have the middle class, and then you have the very rich and the very poor. And so every citizen wants to be in that middle class. But it's a way also to erase all class distinction, all the nuance of being in one or the other, is to erasing the working class as well.
Let's go to a clip. Again, from your film, Orwell, 2 + 2 = 5.
I do not think one can assess a writer's motives without knowing something of his early development. His subject matter will be determined by the age he lives in. At least this is true in tumultuous revolutionary ages like our own. When I was not yet 20, I went to Burma in the Indian Imperial Police. In an outpost of empire like Burma, the class question appeared at first sight to have been shelved. Most of the white men in Burma were not of the type who in England would be called gentlemen. But they were white men, in contradistinction to the other and inferior class, the natives. In the free air of England, that kind of thing is not fully intelligible. In order to hate imperialism, you have got to be part of it. But it is not possible to be part of such a system without recognizing it as an unjustifiable tyranny. Even the thicker-skinned Anglo-Indian is aware of this. Every native face he sees in the street brings home to him his monstrous intrusion. But I was in the police, which is to say that I was part of the actual machinery of despotism.
So that's a clip from Orwell, 2 + 2 = 5. And there we hear about Orwell's experience with colonialism and how that shaped his ideological formation. So, which Raoul just talked about. So, Alex, I'd like you to talk a little bit about, you know, a comment that an Orwell quote that's also in the film, the fact that leaders can claim that something that happened didn't happen, or that 2 + 2 = 5. This fact scares me more than bombs, and this is not a frivolous statement. So if you could elaborate on the significance of and the importance of this in our present moment.
Well, I think that what Orwell was talking about was the idea of authoritarian leaders' assault on common sense. In other words, what you instinctively know to be true is upended by the authoritarian leader so that everything flows from him, usually him. And that's what we're experiencing in this moment. We have a president who you can't even say that he's a liar because he just invents things on the spot, but he expects them to be revered as true. 2 + 2 = 5. That is the effective.
Slogan.
Well, it's the slogan, but that's how he impresses us with his power. That he can make us rudder against our own common sense. That is, and that's the danger we must all. Rise up against. That's the problem at this moment.
The point that also you have in the film, Orwell saying, to be corrupted by totalitarianism, one does not have to live in a totalitarian country.
Right. And I think also, you know, the other thing to remember, I think, that's important here is that what we're living through in this country is not unique. And it's kind of a playbook that that authoritarian leaders go through throughout the world. But also, you know, one of the geniuses, one of the things that's great about Raoul's film is that there's a juxtaposition of present and past, and also country to country, and you can see these same patterns emerge over and over and over again. And it's a kind of a simple playbook to make us all believe that 2 + 2 = 5, or at least to assert that that's the Pledge of Allegiance, 2 + 2 = 5. But it's not unique to Donald Trump, and I think that it's one of the great triumphs of the film.
Raoul Peckin, you told Variety, we are in the hands of a bunch of crazy people who have an agenda totally written out in Project 2025, the same way that Hitler wrote Mein Kampf. And you also, I mean, just talking about Orwell saying, totalitarianism demands, in fact, the continuous alteration of the past, and in the long run, probably demands a disbelief in the very existence of objective truth.
Well, exactly. I think everybody remember when Miss Conway came with the phrase alternative facts, you know, and everybody started laughing about that. But that was what we call the beginning of Newspeak, you know, and where you're actually saying one thing and doing the contrary. The same when Netanyahu at the UN said Israel want peace while they are bombarding Gaza. So the absurdity and the contradiction of this is have invaded our lives. And I know, as again coming from Haiti, I remember as a young boy hearing Kennedy and other presidents talking about democracy, and at the same time they were financing and supporting the dictatorship in my country or in Congo, supporting Mobutu when we were there, and at the same time talking about peace, talking about the good thing that democracy was bringing. So that double language have always existed for the imperialist countries and colonialism. You know, there is the talk, and there is the reality. Mm-hmm. And Orwell, if we can learn something from him, is that he wrote about the reality, not some dystopian future, you know, and we can relate to that, and we can understand how this machine functions.
And so, Raoul, you mentioned Newspeak, and in the film, you give several examples from the contemporary moment: special military operation, which equals invasion of Ukraine; vocational training center, which equals concentration camp, a reference to the Uyghurs in China; legal use of force, police brutality; anti-Semitism 2024 equals weaponized term to silence critics of the Israeli military. Now, if you could talk about, in particular, because you do include it in the film, the proliferation of these terms through a totally new form, social media.
Absolutely. It multiplied that by the million. And we are being bombarded by so-called information, which are absolutely not information. And there is no checking about that. And there is this sequence with Octavio Cortez as well, criticizing or asking Zuckerberg, you know, what is his fact-checking department doing on Facebook? So it's such an enormous problem. Like Orwell tells us that at the moment where you cannot trust language anymore, you're not in a democracy.
Did you leave this film more hopeful or less?
Well, it's hopeful is not a word I can function with. For me, it's about what do you do once you see that something is not functioning. And I think about what response should we make?
What
alliance should... Yes, well, that will be the responsibility of each one of us, you know, wherever we are, journalists as well, politicians, but also the civil society. The response, you know, like Orwell say, the 84% of Oceania, you know, they are the one who has, or he calls them the proles, and they are the one who has to bring a response, like the civil rights movement. You know, it was a coalition of very different people, very different movements, and they succeed in changing this country.
Well, I encourage everyone to see this film. It's at IFC opening tomorrow night here in New York, and then moving on to Los Angeles and then to the rest of the country. Raoul Peck, director of Orwell 2+2=5, Alex Gibney produced the film. Thank you so much, both, for being with us. Next up, a look at life in El Salvador under a total abortion ban with the Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Mariana Hossa. Stay with us. Thank you. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
We turn now to a new investigation into what a no-exceptions abortion ban looks like. Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Maria Hinojosa went to El Salvador, which has one of the world's most restrictive anti-abortion laws, and looked at how women have been incarcerated after losing their babies. In the last two decades since the law was passed, it has prosecuted nearly 200 women for having obstetric emergencies. This is an excerpt of the new episode of Latino USA, produced with Futuro Investigates in partnership with El Faro English. The voices include producer Monica Morales Garcia and begins with host Maria Hinojosa.
We came to speak with women who have been incarcerated for what doctors here call obstetric emergencies. Things like a miscarriage, una pérdida, or going into labor alone, hemorrhaging, or having a stillbirth. Emergencies that can have extreme consequences in a country under a total abortion ban.
And though having a miscarriage or a stillbirth is not technically illegal here, medical professionals, police, and judges avoid making distinctions to steer clear of criminal prosecution for being involved in what the government might define as an abortion.
What does that look like in practice? Well, reports show doctors and nurses can end up calling the police when women are having a miscarriage. Let that sink in.
For more on this investigation, headlined From Pregnancy to Murder Charge, Living Under a Total Abortion Ban, we are joined by Maria Hinojosa, Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist, host of Latino USA, founder of Futuro Media, author of Once I Was You. Welcome back to Democracy Now! This is powerful, profound, and a warning. Talk about why you looked at this issue in El Salvador.
Well, Amy, it's so great to be with the both of you. When I first heard this from a Salvadoran friend here, she said, "Ay, Maria, they're putting women in prison in El Salvador for having a miscarriage." I was like, this is misinformation. And I actually texted Cecile Richards, may she rest in peace, former president of Planned Parenthood. And I said, "Cecile, this is what I'm hearing. Is this true?" She said, "Yes." And that's when I said, "I've got to go. I have to see this." And I had a sensation that it was not just about seeing what's happening in El Salvador, but we have a president, right, that looks at El Salvador and says, "They have martial law. I want martial law. They put people in prison without any due process. I want to do that. Total abortion ban, could it happen in the United States?" And that's why I said, I have to go. By the way, South Carolina, this will probably pass early 2026 in South Carolina. This could start to happen here in the United States.
Well, how many women in El Salvador have been incarcerated?
It's really hard to say. So the women who we met, who spent time in prison, who were charged. In one case, Theo, who was left alone, gave birth, woke up hemorrhaging, and her baby was dead. They never told her how or why. She told me and others that she believes that 90% of the women who are in prison in El Salvador are in prison for this.
Even now?
Even now. The thing is hard to believe, but if you are a woman in prison in El Salvador and you come in with this charge, you are treated worse than a woman pedophile. So you are beaten, you are spit upon, you are denied food, you are tortured because of this particular charge. Therefore, the women don't ever say, "I'm here because of this." And that's why it's very hard to get the hold of the numbers. But you have to trust the people who actually were inside those prisons, like Theo.
You're talking about Bukele's El Salvador, the close ally of Trump. Trump sent hundreds of men to the Sacot prison, a place you tried to get into, but Bukele personally said no, you couldn't get into that prison. Relate that to the total abortion ban and what's happening to women and the fight back of leading feminists there.
Right. So I know when we were going to El Salvador and I was like, we want to get into Sacot, we want to get into the women's prison. And our producer down there was just like, you know, I'm like, who else should we appeal to? And he was like, yeah, no, ultimately, Bukele decides who from the outside gets into the prison. So he knows that we were attempting to get into both Sacot and the women's prisons. We know he said no. The reality is that the Bukele administration has such control over everything. That night, I was in El Salvador, the night the first planes left from the United States, taking removed people from the United States into El Salvador. But it was all done in the cover of darkness, which is the code here, the cover of darkness. But there is a shining light. As you know, at Futuro Media, we really believe in showing media that has, well, truth, but also hope. The women like Teo, who was sentenced to 30 years, she spent 11. She came
one
out.
One of the last 17.
I'm sorry?
One of the last 17.
One of las 17, yes. One of the original las 17 is how it all started. This is the 17 women who became public about the fact that they were in prison for having a miscarriage or a stillborn. She now has a halfway house. They run theater programs for formerly incarcerated women. They have dance programs. They exercise. I'm going to be exercising with them together on Zoom. Now that the story is out, I can do that. So they are hopeful, right? And that is the light at the end of the tunnel, as you know, Amy, because we've covered it for so long. El Salvador has a complicated political history of which the United States is a huge part of. But the women's movement, the feminist movement, is still there, still present, still targeted by Bukele, but they are not quiet. They are not silenced.
We're going to do a Spanish interview with you after the show, and we're going to post online at democracynow.org. Mariana Hossa, Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist, host of Latino USA, founder of Futuro Media. Last 20 seconds, the feminist movement, do you think they can prevail there?
A dictator does not last forever. This cannot last forever. The only way it changes is with people power, just as Raul Peck said. It's what each of us decide to do with this moment.
And do you think they represent the majority view in El Salvador?
I think that it's changing. I think that people are seeing this and they are getting horrified, and they're not necessarily that much safer.
Well, I want to thank you so much for being with us. We're going to link to From Pregnancy to Murder Charge, Living Under a Total Abortion Ban. As we end today's show with the words of the renowned primatologist and conservationist Jane Goodall, who's died at the age of 91. We interviewed her at the Paris Climate Summit in 2015.
Well, I listened to Donald Trump saying, you know, that he doesn't believe that we've caused or are causing climate change, and some of the other right-wing leaders. And I just ask myself, do they really believe what they're saying? Because it seems so very obvious. And if you read the facts, I don't see how you can come to any other conclusion but that it's our misuse of fossil fuels, the emissions from agriculture, from industry, from households, the vast impact that's being made by this intensive farming of animals.
Jane Goodall has died at the age of 91. We interviewed her a number of times on Democracy Now!, most recently back in 2015 at the Paris Climate Summit. To see that full interview and all the others, go to democracynow.org. This coming weekend, I'll be speaking Saturday, October 4th, at the Roxy Theater in San Francisco after the showing of Steal This Story, Please, a new documentary about Democracy Now!, and on Sunday, October 5th, in Berkeley at BAMFA for the Q&A after. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh for another edition of Democracy Now!
You are now listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting from Burnaby, BC.
My name's Eric Swanson, and I'm a dad of two young girls. It was a game changer when we learned that $10 a day childcare was being offered to both our kids. And we want all BC families to have this option. To get there, BC has to do three key things. Pay fair and consistent wages for all childcare educators. Transition all existing programs to $10 a day, and plan childcare expansion more like we do schools and hospitals. BC's on the right track, but we need to go faster. Go to 10aday.ca to learn more.